Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. We'll be closing out the year and greeting the new one with two remarkable women. As you know, we lost the well-known Louisiana artist George Rodrigue recently. We'll be remembering him with his wife, Wendy Rodrigue, in an interview about her book, The Other Side of the Painting, recorded earlier this year. We'll also hear from writer Ann Patchett, whose new essay collection is This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. And I'll have a few thoughts on my favorite literary events of 2013. You might know Wendy Rodrigue as a face in a painting, a beautiful face in a painting by her husband, well-known artist George Rodrigue. You might also know her as the wife of that famous artist, as a gallery owner, and now meet her as a writer. She is the author of the new memoir, The Other Side of the Painting. It's an up-close and personal view of life as an artist partner and muse. Wendy, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan.
This is quite a substantial book. It's a record of your life, your marriage, the joys and challenges of living with an artist over time. Tell us how you got started and how long you've been working on it.
Well, I've been working on it for about 4 years, and it did not start off as a book. It started off as a blog online, a twice-weekly blog. And that started off really to answer people's questions. As the internet became more and more popular, we received more and more questions, not only from collectors and fans of George's work, but also a lot from students and journalists and people doing research in general. And a lot of the questions were the same questions. Where did the blue dog come from? Who's in the Aioli dinner? How do you pronounce Rodrigue? All these kinds of questions. So I found myself answering these questions again and again in various degrees of detail. I was in between projects, and I thought, you know, I'm going to start writing these things out in an online format with absolutely every detail I can possibly muster of answers to these same questions so that when people ask, I can just send them a link. And it caught on very quickly, and I was very surprised. And George encouraged me within the first, 6 months or so of the project. He said, you know, you should get broader in this and start interjecting more personal observations and getting broader in your approach. And so I did, and to my surprise, that seemed to resonate with folks.
Oh, absolutely. Now, one of the things that charmed me as a reader is the way you capture so perfectly how people who are falling in love reveal themselves to one another over time, how you learn about childhoods, families, dreams for the future, secrets. That must have been so much fun to write.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. I mean, I'm so glad that you noticed that or that that came through in the book. That was really fun to write, but honestly, that's a daily part of my life. I mean, I am with George all the time. We do everything together. And so, as we all know in relationships, that maybe the most wonderful thing about relationships is getting to know the other person, this person that you love and admire. And our favorite trip, by the way, every year, and I write about this in the book, is we cross the country once a year in our truck, sometimes twice a year, and we will spend 2 to 3 weeks on the road, and we have rules in the truck, and that is no reading, no books on tape. It's very specific because the whole objective is to get to know each other better. And we love that. It's a constant thing in our lives, even after 23 years. So.
That's a great tradition, especially if you like each other's driving, I guess, you know.
Well, George does most of the driving.
I had a feeling. Oh, man. But a lot of the blog entries in this book also take that kind of form of postcards from the road, from places as diverse as Marfa and Santa Fe.
Yeah. Yeah, and as a matter of fact, for years I wrote a lot of postcards from the road, and I pulled some of those references from those old cards. George's mother lived to be 103, And she lived with us for several years when we first got married, and she was constantly concerned when George wasn't working. It was a big thing for her that George always be working. She was worried about his pension all the time. And so I used to constantly send these postcards from the road and intermixed with reassuring her that he was selling paintings on the road, whether or not that was true. I always sent these little vignettes of our adventures, and I pulled a lot of those things for the book and the blog post.
And one of the things that comes through this book loud and clear is that he's one of the hardest working artists you can imagine. You know,
yeah,
it's just now one of
he paints all the time.
Well,
but if he's not painting, he's out on the road selling his work, or I don't know, working with the foundation, or there's always something going on. He would say the hardest work is schmoozing at events and parties.
Oh, amen to that. But this is also, in addition to being a very personal book, it's a very writerly book, and you draw on your own reading and writing over the years. So tell us a little bit about your affection for Virginia Woolf.
Oh, that was truly, when I wrote that blog, and I, as with everything in the book, I completely reworked things to put them in the book and to put them into a flow in the book. That was one of the big ones that I reworked. But it was the first time in my blog that I really took a chance and got personal. I relate so much to Virginia Woolf, particularly her writing in A Room of One's Own. And that book is constantly by my bedstand, and I'm always referring to it. And I related to her being married to also a renowned husband, creative husband, and being in his shadow and yet also finding her own way. I constantly find myself turning to her words. And then, of course, she eventually took her own life. I don't have that on my, I don't mean to laugh, I shouldn't laugh when I say that because it was very tragic, but I don't have that on my radar. But it's interesting to me because she felt confident in everything that she said and everything that she put out there, while at the same time, in a way, being defined by her husband and by men. So I don't know. It was the first time I made myself that vulnerable in my writing when I wrote that post. And it surprised me because a lot of women in particular seem to relate to it.
Well, a lot of us think about her a lot, you know?
Yeah.
All the time. A Room of One's Own means so much to any woman who's writing ever. Now, one of the great joys of your marriage, which you recount in such lovely detail, is what it's like to see art through the eyes of an artist. It's like you have a captive artist to talk to you about art all the time.
That's true. I do. Yeah, I mentioned in the book, I've got this artist at my fingertips to watch these movies with about, you know, Pollock or Frida or so many movies that have been made on artists, and to look at art books with. We sit and look at art books all the time. When we travel, we hit every possible museum. We love public installations. We love to go to artist studios. And I do think it's interesting to me, because I talk to so many artists, I find that that is not a very common thing. It's not as common as I thought it would be. I figured all artists would be curious about other artists and want to see all these things. And that's not always the case. A lot of artists are real loners and don't have that interest. But George does. And so it is very fun for me, as I feel shy about saying I'm an art historian, but I am trained as an art historian, and I do have a passion for the art history and what's going on in the arts today. And it's just so great to always have this artist at my fingertips to make these explorations and then discuss them afterwards.
Now, so much of this book is a biography of George, from his very early paintings to selling them out of the trunk of his car. That made me think of John Grisham in A Time to Kill, you know, going around the South selling the book, and to his fabulous success. But it's also really your story as well. I mean, it's a love story. It's a story of you growing into yourself as a writer. I'd love to know what you learned about yourself from writing this book.
The number one thing is, I can't believe anybody cares. cares about me, but cares what happened to me, cares about my life. I just can't believe people find it interesting. I just am shocked by it, to be honest.
Well, didn't you? I mean, it had to interest you as you kept on writing. Well, this is quite a lot of work.
But except that everybody's got a life and everybody's got interesting things in their lives. And it's just shocking to me that all the things that I always found just really normal and figured, you know, everybody had going on. Why would they want to read about it? They lived it too. that people actually find interesting. It really surprises me. And then, so that has been very revealing to me, was that, as a matter of fact, my life is not like everybody else's. We all have very unique things, and for some reason people find it interesting, the life I grew up in. You know, my mother, I write a lot about my mom in the book, and she was an artist, and I grew up in this house, this art bubble of a house that, you know, had turquoise walls and Persian carpets that my parents hand-carried back from, well, overseas when my father was stationed in Vietnam. They went on to all of these incredible journeys and went to Iran and Iraq and went all over Europe. And because I grew up in a military family and in this house, I assumed everybody lived a life like that and had these things around. And then that my parents divorced when I was such a young child, and my mother's dating life was such a big deal when I was growing up, I didn't realize until much later that there weren't all that many divorced households, you know, in the 70s with children 1 and 6 years old and mothers that were actively dating, and like my mother was. I don't know. It's an interesting thing. I've learned a lot about it. It's made me appreciate the life that I grew up in much more. A lot of people took pity on me for things like that, and I never saw it that way. And this book gave me an opportunity to shout that from the rooftops, that I had a wonderful childhood and felt very loved, and that I think that's the most important thing.
Well, it's like that wonderful quotation from Colette, "I've had a really interesting life. I just wish I'd realized it sooner." I just love
that. That's right.
Oh.
You don't know it while you're in it.
No, you never do. Oh, well, it's a wonderful book. We've been talking with Wendy Rodrigue, whose charming new book is The Other Side of the Painting. Thank you so much, Wendy.
Thank you, Susan. I really appreciate it.
Ann Patchett is one of my favorite writers. The author of 6 novels, most notably The Patron Saint of Liars, Bel Canto, and State of Wonder, as well as 3 works of nonfiction, including Truth and Beauty. Her new book this fall is a revelatory and charming collection of personal essays, The Story of a Happy Marriage. One of our most honored authors, Anne is also an independent bookseller and owner of Parnassus Books in Nashville, Tennessee, which opened a great fanfare in 2011. And in 2012, Time magazine named her one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Welcome to The Reading Life, Anne.
I'm so happy to be here, Susan.
Well, it's a pleasure and an honor to have you. Now, one of the great pleasures of this collection is seeing your work over time and realizing how long I've been reading it. And many of the essays are about writing, specifically your writing life and the teachers who've been important to you and the advice you have for young writers. Did you get a different sense of your own writing life putting this together?
That's interesting. It wasn't so much a sense of my own writing life that I got as much as it was a sense of my emotional life and working life. I really wasn't thinking so much about my writing as I went over these pieces, but I did think, I hadn't realized what a worker I was. I think of myself as lazy, and I think that a lot of writers do, because we don't go to work and we stay home, and, you know, if I have an amazing work day, I work 4 hours. And so I always think of myself as a little bit of a bum. And when I started going through all of the articles and essays that I had written, there were hundreds of them. And I thought, wow, you know, I really have been showing up all these years.
And yes, I'm sure if we did a word search of the word work in this book, it would pop up constantly. You know?
I'm a big believer in work. And more as I get older, I'm so tired of the idea of talent and creativity. It came to me recently that talent is a match, and having a career as a writer is spending your whole life inside of a warm house. You don't spend your whole life in a warm house by a match. You spend it by splitting wood. And, you know, lovely match, grateful, really glad that fire was started back in childhood. But that's just not what it's about anymore. It really is about showing up and sitting down and doing it every day.
Well, I do love that early determination you had and felt. I mean, that's a lovely thing to read about, you know?
It is, and I was very, very lucky for that, because I was someone, even as a kid, who really knew what I wanted to do, and I never wavered from it. I never had a moment where I thought, well, you know, maybe law school would be a good idea. You know, I'm the original one-trick pony. Whenever I hear that song on the radio, I sort of have to pull over and close my eyes and listen to it, because I feel like it's my personal anthem.
That's great. Now, one of the things I do love about you is that you do admit that you've had some incredible luck in your teachers, in your circumstances,
oh, yeah,
in your financial success. And yet, I think this collection does show how much of it was hard, hard work, and that you were brave and fearless for it. You have done lots of extraordinary things to make your work possible.
It's true, and a lot of stupid things to make my work possible. But this is a career that, no matter how talented you are and how hardworking you are, luck really does just play a big factor. It's a little bit like being pretty and talented and saying, I'm going to Hollywood to be a movie star. You know, it just might not work out, no matter how great you are. So I think that you can never overlook luck. But luck also works both ways, and I say that in the book. And when I was an undergraduate at Sarah Lawrence, I had phenomenal luck with my teachers. I studied for a year with Alan Gurganis, and then Grace Paley, and then Russell Banks. It was astonishing, astonishing. You couldn't ask for three better teachers, and they were classes of 12 students, and they went on for a year, and you met individually every week, and they came to the cafeteria and cut your meat up for you. But when I went to the fabled Iowa Writers Workshop right when I got out of college, I really had bad luck. Again, just luck of the draw. I didn't have good teachers, and it's not that it's a bad school or it was a faulted institution, but I think anytime you show up, it just depends on who you happen to sign up for. You don't know.
Right. Now, one of the things I really loved, which of course I struggle with myself, is that when you wrote that you thought the ability to forgive oneself is the key to making art.
No, it's the key to life.
It really is.
The key to everything. You just have to forgive yourself. I am not anywhere near as smart as I wish I were. I'm not anywhere near as talented. And every time I try to translate the beautiful book into my head onto a piece of paper, I am confronted with that. If I was smarter, if I was more talented, if I was a harder worker, I could do this more gracefully. I could get what I see in my mind onto paper. And I can't. But I can forgive myself. And I think that that's where a lot of people go off the rails. If you're in eighth grade and you're writing your Western Civilization paper, you know, and you just think, oh, this is horrible, and you keep hitting delete and hitting delete. Or if you're writing your eighth novel, it's just hard to see how little we can put the genius of our ideas down onto the page.
I know. It's always so grand in conception and design.
It really is.
Well, you've had some pretty grand canvases that you've created, after all.
Well, I have a good imagination. Interesting. I've always prided myself as a novelist as being somebody who works from my imagination. You know, no one in my family is going to be embarrassed by my books. And now this is a book that could embarrass people or make people uncomfortable. It's true. It's very personal. And I just thought, well, you know, it's time. I'm ready now. I'm anxious to see how this book will affect my fiction, because I think that I'm ready to write the Romana Clef that I should have written when I was 25.
Oh, boy.
I was so hell-bent to make sure that I was never going to write any book that was going to embarrass anybody. And now I'm thinking, oh, really, who cares?
Well, we really can't wait for that one. And this is going back to a form that was very important in your apprenticeship, in your early days as a writer, isn't it?
Well, it was very important as my apprenticeship as a writer, and it was also very important for paying the rent and eating.
Exactly.
When I was 22, I think, I sold a short story to 17 Magazine. And then I asked my editor if I could write nonfiction, because I knew that I could only publish one story in the magazine every year, if I was lucky, but that you could publish nonfiction every month. And I was just really thinking about this from the financial point of view. And the first job they ever gave me, I think it was a 250-word or 200-word review of this first novel called The Joy Luck Club by a fresh young writer named Amy Tan. And I just kept badgering them at 17. Well, you know, could I write something else? Could I write something else? And they would have me write 10 pieces, and then maybe they would publish one of them. So it really did teach me an awful lot about work and about just getting over myself. 17 stomped out any feelings I might have ever had. And that really carried over into fiction, too. That, you know, if I wrote something that I thought was fabulous in a novel, and then I realized it didn't really advance the story, it really wasn't the point, I could get rid of it. Because, boy, that's what working for magazines teaches you how to do.
Oh, right. And newspapers, too.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. Be fast, be accurate, be short. Those aren't bad lessons.
All right. Get it done. We have to talk about the title essay, The Story of a Happy Marriage.
Yeah.
I might also add that there are several stories of unhappy marriages in this collection from your family.
Yes. We specialized in unhappy marriages in my family. We have divorced going back at least four generations in my family. And really, everywhere you look, everybody is divorced. I believe that I only have one cousin out of, I don't know, 30 or however many there are, who is married to their original spouse.
Wow.
We're bummers where marriage is concerned.
Well, you do have a very happy marriage now, and that was a lot of work. It took you a lot of time to get to that point, didn't it?
It did. My husband and I dated for 11 years.
I know. I love that.
Before we got married. And we didn't live together. We lived down the street from each other. And when I got divorced when I was 25, and I had one of those sort of Scarlett O'Hara in the field moments, you know, as God is my witness, I will never be hungry again. But really, as God is my witness, I will never be married. If I get out of this, I will never make this mistake again. And that was my 25-year-old solemn oath, and I took it really seriously. So when I met Carl and we dated, sometimes happily, sometimes unhappily, but for 11 years, and he really wanted to get married. He, of course, was divorced, because I've never met anyone who wasn't divorced, and he really, really wanted to get married, and I just said, there's no way. I'm not going to wreck it, and so I kept my promise for a long time.
Well, I love it that you didn't say it was the secret. It was just the story of happy marriage.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Even that title was so cringe-inducing to me for a long time, and I've just barely gotten to the point where I can say it out loud. I think it's a really good title, and as a bookseller, as someone who owns a bookstore and looks at titles up on shelves, I think this is a great title. You know, I am the one who decided I wanted the book to come out in early November. I think this is going to be a great book for Christmas, but it's very hard for me to say the title because it really feels like I'm bringing the evil eye on myself. And in the year before the book was published, every time Carl and I would have an argument, one of us would say, oh, this is just great. This is great. There's this story of a happy marriage book coming out, and, you know, look at us now.
Will we make it?
Will we make it? Carl kept saying to me, why did you call the book that?
Well, say, you know, it's partly the story of your happy marriage with writing, too. I mean, of course.
And that's what I hope people will come to. And I should say quickly, my marriage really is very happy. But it's a book about commitment.
Yes.
I mean, it's a book about the marriage vows. And whether it is to writing, to art, to work, to dogs, to family members, to friends, to book selling, you know, it's sort of to all the things I believe in. I'm saying I am sticking this out.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what, I am going to stick this out.
Well, I loved reading the essays about Rose, and I hope that Sparky is making you very happy.
Sparky is actually actually in my lap.
Ah,
just a second.
I knew it.
I'm making him happy. He is making me happy.
And how is your life as a bookseller these days?
Busy. There are a lot of people on tour this fall, and we are very lucky to be having many of them come through Nashville and come to Parnassus. You know, summer is peaceful, except for the whole summer reading thing.
Oh,
that
yeah.
That keeps us busy, kids coming in and wanting their summer reading books. But once the fall hits, we have the big tours coming through, and you start to feel, in a literary sense, like a rock and roll venue. Amy Tan is coming, and Donna Tartt, and Liz Gilbert, and Pat Conroy, and, you know, it's really thrilling, but it's like you just turn around, and wow, there's another one. And then I'm going out on tour, so it's a lot to balance, but it's really fun. As I say, every day of my life, thank God for Karen Hayes, who is the co-owner of the bookstore and the person who actually is there day in, day out, doing all the work.
Well, and everyone is very, very happy with this venture. It's one of the loveliest bookstores I've ever seen.
Oh, thank you.
As you know.
I love it. And you know what's so funny? This is a terrible thing to admit, but I've really gotten to a point in my life a long time ago where I am not so comfortable in bookstores, because bookstores to me mean book tour. And either the book tour, it takes two forms. The early book tour, where I sat forlorn and alone at a table at the back by myself, and nobody came and talked to me, and that was embarrassing and sad. And now when I go into bookstores, there are several hundred people waiting for me to tell me everything while holding onto my wrist very tightly, and that can be a little overwhelming. And for a long time, I felt like a bookstore was a place I wanted to get out of. So it's really been fantastic for me to have Parnassus, which is just physically this place I love, and it has a wonderful vibe, and every time I walk in the store, I'm happy. And Sparky works in the store. A lot of days when I'm not there, I just drop him off in the morning. It's like the little school bus. He goes in and works his shift as the store dog, and then I pick him up.
I know. All those years I worked in bookstores, I was never unhappy to be there. It was magical.
It's true. It's really true. And when I worked in a bookstore in my 20s, I loved it. But as an author, my relationship to bookstores really changed. And now I feel like it's changed back to experience I had when I was young.
Well, we've been speaking with the ever delightful Ann Patchett, whose new essay collection is The Story of a Happy Marriage. Thank you so much, Ann.
Thank you, Susan. It was great to talk to you.
It's the end of the year, traditionally a time for best of lists and taking stock, so I thought I'd look back at some of the moments I enjoyed most in 2013. Judging the edible book contest at the New Orleans Museum of Art in April was so much fun. That same weekend, there was an edible book festival at the Alvar branch of the New Orleans Public Library. Edible books were everywhere, an endless tribute to the creativity of readers. I loved being part of the Don Quixote One Time One Book Pop-Up Book Club at Belloc on the Katrinaversary in August. Thanks, Ted O'Brien and Susie Penman, for coming up with that idea. And yes, even I had to scramble to finish the book. Two of my favorite interviews were with Anne and Christopher Rice as they toured together in support of their books, The Wolves of Midwinter and The Heavens Rise. It was the first time in a long time that they had been in New Orleans for the Vampire Lestat Fan Club's Halloween Ball. It was also fun to interview my radio crush, Garrison Keillor, before his appearance here for Prairie Home Companion. It's always a year of festivals in Louisiana, and book lovers have their share, for sure. The Louisiana Book Festival drew its largest crowd ever in November, more than 29,000, and it was wonderful to see Christine Wiltz receive the Louisiana Writer Award this year. Saints and Sinners Literary Festival had its 10th anniversary outing in May, and the Tennessee Williams Festival turned 27 this March. Words and Music held its annual gathering in December. Reza Aslan was the keynote speaker for that event. Earlier in the year, we had the pleasure of seeing him stand his ground when Lauren Kelly of Fox News questioned his motives in writing Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, which became a bestseller, possibly as a result. Aslan is a former New Orleanian, you know. The Walker Percy Center for Writing and Publishing at Loyola held its second conference, Still Lost in the Cosmos, Walker Percy in the 21st Century, in October. Team Slam New Orleans, our poetry team led by Justin Lamb, did us all proud by winning the national championship this year in Boston. New talent is always coming along in our city, as are new festivals. The Hands-On Literary Festival debuts with the new year this year. And for those of you who've noticed little free libraries popping up all over town, and they're those sweet wooden structures in folks' front yards, you're right. There are a lot of them now. The number has more than doubled in 2013, with more than 40 in New Orleans. The national news in literary terms seem to veer from the sublime to the ridiculous. First, a new study showed that reading fiction increases empathy for our fellow human beings, as if we really needed an excuse to read more novels. The ridiculous? Well, we'll see if those Amazon drones will be along, delivering books in 30 minutes. I count myself very lucky that I can walk or drive to three fine indie bookstores in less than that time. Perhaps one of the biggest literary stories of the year was the appearance of the film version of 12 Years a Slave by Solomon Northup, and the way this Louisiana classic, published in 1853, finally received its rightful share of attention. Looking forward, Wendell Pierce secured a book deal with Riverhead for his memoir, What's the Good of Losing Heart Now? That sounds like a perfect title to sail into the coming year with. Local reading in 2013 was plentiful and memorable. First, the fiction. There were some wonderful novels this year. Bill Lofelm finally ventured into New Orleans territory with his fine new thriller, The Devil in Her Way. George Bishop charmed with The Night of the Comet, set in small-town Louisiana. Christine Wiltz crafted a wicked post-Katrina caper with Shoot the Money. Kent Wascom's Blood of Heaven took us back to the wild and woolly history of the Florida parishes. And James Lee Burke? Well, I said that Light of the World was the best Burke yet, but then I say that about every new book of his. New Orleanian Nathaniel Rich had a storm story of his own in Against All Odds. And Ruta Sepetys, inspired by Christine Wiltz's The Last Madam, pictured an unusual French Quarter upbringing in her young adult novel, Out of the Easy. 2013 seemed a particularly strong year for nonfiction. Among the highlights, Sherry Fink's harrowing 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital, which was a New York Times bestseller and was named one of the year's 10 best books by the New York Times. Fink appeared here during the JCC Book Fair. Other books added to our knowledge of New Orleans history this year. N.O. Lit, 200 Years of New Orleans Literature, is Nancy Dixon's impressive anthology of our literary heritage. Philip Collier's Making New Orleans Products Past and Present is a gorgeous visual history of some of the best-known creations from New Orleans in every area, from Higgins boats to hot sauce. Company Man, The Remarkable French Atlantic Voyage of a Clerk for the Company of the Indies, a memoir by Marc-Antoine Caillot, was edited by Aaron Greenwald and translated by Terry Chalmers and published by the Historic New Orleans Collection. It illuminates the very early days of our city. And Errol Laborde's long-awaited Mardi Gras Chronicles of New Orleans Carnival is a beautiful addition to our body of carnival knowledge. Emily Clark's The Strange History of the American Quadroon, Free Women of Color in the Revolutionary Atlantic World, removes some of the myths about our city's racial heritage, and Kim Vaz's fascinating Baby Dolls, Breaking the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition, gave us a new look at the history of African-American women in New Orleans. Emily Epstein Landau's Spectacular Wickedness, Sex, Race, and Memory in Storyville, New Orleans, took us back to one of the most popular literary destinations. Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children by Sarah Carr, probed the post-Katrina educational experiment with heart and depth. Rebecca Thieme brought a lot of passion to her chronicle of the changing newspaper scene, Hell and High Water, the battle to save the Daily Times-Picayune. An Unfathomable City, An Atlas of New Orleans, edited by Rebecca Snedeker and Rebecca Solnit, drew on the work of some of our very best writers and artists to map the city's terrain in powerful new ways. There were some fascinating memoirs in 2013 as well. Peter Wolfe, My New Orleans Gone Away, was a lovely memoir about the changing fortunes of several once prominent New Orleans families. Wendy Rodrigue's lovely memoir and blog entries, The Other Side of the Painting, is an intimate look at life with the artist George Rodrigue, whom we lost in December. And Jesmyn Ward stunned audiences with Men We Reaped, a memoir of losing 5 young African-American men in a very short time. There were some gorgeous artistic collaborations this year as well. New York artist Michael Hoftka illustrated Roger Kamenetz's poems in The Gorgeous to Die Next to You. Writer Michael Allen Zell teamed up with Jeff Louvier and Vanessa Brown for the mysterious Oblivion Atlas. And Eric Bookhart edited an amazing survey of contemporary New Orleans photography and Inventing Reality, New Orleans Visionary Photography. That was for Luna Press, which continues to produce beautiful books. Finally, it was disconcerting for me to be on the signing end of book signings when my revised Book Lover's Guide to New Orleans came out this fall. A big thank you to all the booksellers and readers who made that book so welcome in the world. Now it's onward to 2014 and all the books to come. Here's wishing you a happy new year of reading. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The New Orleans Public Library kicks off a new monthly series of appearances by local authors this year. First up, Larry Powell. He discusses and signs The Accidental City, Improvising New Orleans, Tuesday, January 7th from 5:30 to 7 at Ladder Library. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses Tom Rackman's The Imperfectionist, Tuesday, January 7th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop. Liz Williams of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum interviews WWNO's Poppy Tooker, Tuesday, January 7th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And if your resolution is to read more of the great books next year, there will be a great books discussion group held at 7 p.m. on the first and third Tuesdays of every month at the Old Metairie Branch Library, free of charge. Sessions start January 7th at 7 p.m. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.